Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show. All right, we're back, and Nick is back from the dead.
Yeah, that was pretty cool, Nick.
Why do you keep making me a zombie? I hate zombies. What am I doing?
We didn't say you're a zombie, just said you were dead.
But Nick has now revealed that he's a zombie.
Yes.
Oh, so, man, I did
that's how you can, defeat zombies. You defeat vampires by either using a steak or garlic or a cowboy with a Bowie knife.
Yes.
You defeat the mummy with fire, I think.
And you have to undo the curse.
Werewolves with silver. Yeah. And zombies by getting them to admit that they're zombies.
Yeah. It's kind of like a cop can't lie.
Yeah.
Which we know is
Are you a zombie? You have to tell me.
Untrue. We're going to write that down as a yes.
Yep.
And the curse is broken.
Yep. So Nick's not a zombie anymore.
But we're happy to have we're happy to have formerly zombie Nick, formerly dead, formerly zombie Nick.
Back as regular non-zombie, non-dead Nick.
Back from Costa Rica, a.k.a. the land of the dead.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. I ran across zero zombies.
That's what a zombie would say.
Exactly. It was a big zombie party. But yeah, we're getting into the holiday months. Randy, I know you've got a little bit of you'll be talking some holiday movies at the end of this.
We have our holiday hours.
We have our holiday hours up and running.
We're open until 8 p.m. on Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
Yep.
We have our white elephant gifts up again.
Yep.
Which are Jeanette lovingly wrapped these packages. They're nicer than any gift I've ever wrapped in my life.
Yes, it's very impressive.
They even have cool tags.
Yeah, so
I think the tags make it.
Jeanette added this year. So you bet it's either $30, $20, or if you get one of the books, $10, I think.
Yep, I think that's right.
And they're all pre-wrapped gifts. They're sort of blind. You don't know what you're getting. But the tags have on the back the age range, the number of players, and sort of the complexity of it.
Yeah.
And then on the flip side of that tag, it's blank. So you can just basically take this thing, you see what's on the tag, you flip it over, you put your name to and from, you're done. You're done. You've got your white elephant gift, you've got your present for your kid
and like
that you forgot to buy.
And like you're saying, expertly wrapped.
Better wrapping than I've ever done in my life.
Yep. Let's all have a big round of applause for Jeanette.
Yep.
Yay.
Okay, very good.
Yeah, but anyway, so this is a good thing if you're looking for last-minute gifts or just like for a white elephant exchange, where like, yeah, no gifts over $20, it's exactly $20.
Yep. And we should mention statues.
Oh yeah, and the statues. We're discounting our statues down to $50.
Yeah, from their typical price of $75 to $100, with the larger ones more commonly coming at $100 these days. So it's pretty huge. Yep. I would act now.
All right. Not as big of a bunch of games as last week, but we did get a couple new ones. The White Castle Matcha, the expansion to the White Castle dice game that is a Japanese-themed like samurai game.
Right. No relation to the American connotation for White Castle.
It is a really great game, and I'm curious what the expansion brings to it. And that same company did a game called Daitoshi, which is a sort of a medium to heavyweight resource management game, I believe. The pitch on that one is you're expanding a city, electrifying its districts, and discovering and developing new steam-powered inventions and trade with faraway cities.
Huh, okay.
Yeah. I just want a board game now that's Samurais versus White Castle. I don't know what the connotations of that would be, if they're flying hamburgers or you know, sliders.
Like the Burger Time video game, hamburgers.
Yep. Oh, Daitoshi also has yokai.
Okay.
It's a steam. You've mastered the power of steam, you're building a city, but there are rivers and forests guarded by the yokai.
See, I thought this might have actually been a game that was just set during, like, an Industrial Revolution type period, but it's in magical fantasy land.
Exactly. all right. We also got the WizKids put out a bunch of stuff. We've got the Quest for the Infinite Staircase, which is the newest D&D minis.
Yep.
We have the Black Panther Heroclix.
Yep.
We have the Beetlejuice Heroclix. It's one of their iconics where you get one. It's Beetlejuice. You get Beetlejuice.
They're Beetlejuice Heroclix?
Mm-hmm.
So I could finally have Beetlejuice face off against Professor Xavier?
Yes.
Interesting.
And then there's
versus Kong.
And then there's a Superman Heroclix that is the Superman up and away. It's Superman changing in a phone booth, basically.
Which is awesome.
That's pretty cool. These are the ones that are like more nicely painted and all that.
Yeah.
Fancy. They're fancy.
The fancy ones.
All right, let's talk about comics for the week. It is this is the first week of December. We always get some good stuff on first week of the month.
I felt it was a pretty strong week for me. Maybe an especially good showing from Marvel.
Yep. Let's talk about All New Venom.
Right. One of the ones that, frankly, was not particularly on my list, although I was interested to try it because it's written by Al Ewing, whose big claim to fame for some years was Immortal Hulk. Like, that really put him on the map. And he's done good stuff before and since, but that is what you know him for if you know him for anything. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. This is sort of... there is a mystery around this. The identity of the new Venom is unknown. And when we first heard that, Randy, you and I both thought, well, this is stupid.
Yeah, nobody wants a mysterious Venom.
Want Eddie Brock, or really, that's what they want. They want Eddie Brock, and I think that's fair. Al Ewing is a writer not to be underestimated, and he is a guy known for doing kind of unusual takes, but also respecting the continuity. And so this issue is sort of staged around a trial, actually, where, like, there is a big sort of violent attack in which Venom shows up, and there are people there that are almost certainly the candidates for who could have been Venom, but who were, like, off-site or not on cameras and stuff like that when it happened. And it looks like they're going to be dangling a mystery. I guess I don't want to say who the candidates are, right?
I mean, I don't think it... 100%
I think you could say it, actually,
but I like that Ewing, like you said, kind of utilizes stuff from Spider-Man, like, just Marvel continuity in general, because this is direct fallout of the New York, like, the gang war that happened.
Yep. You know what, by the way, I liked about that? I hadn't read any of that, but it gave me a sense that it was this kind of cool thing that had happened. It's not going to make me necessarily go out and pick it up, but it did make it feel like it was part of the big Marvel shared continuity a way I liked.
And they mentioned Venom War. And,
also well done.
Yeah. But yeah.
You were excited to see a character that you don't see too often.
Because the trial is Madam Mask. I just have a fond of she's a cool
primarily
character.
An Iron Man villain?
She is, yes.
And often the head of the Magia?
Yep.
Yes.
She is Count Nefaria's daughter.
Count Nefaria's daughter, that's right. This is a great piece of art, by the way, on the opening page. It is just Madam Mask being held in, like, under kind of like high-tech lock and chain like S.H.I.E.L.D. would have her.
I like the fact that but they let her keep her mask.
What's that?
I like that they let her keep her mask. I mean, she just wears that. We don't know what she looks like underneath, but...
She might have... She probably has explosives planted, and they can't get off.
If she's not wearing the mask, they're not sure they're prosecuting the right person.
That actually becomes
Madam.
But that actually comes into play of whether this is actually Madam Mask. That's actually one of the big things in the beginning of this. And there is a character from AIM that shows up that kind of is... let's say a specialist.
Do we want to say... So we should say she is one of the candidates for Venom because the suit looks all like the very jacked up Venom we often get, but it's pretty clear that you could have almost anything under that.
Well, it also has some gold tones that might reflect a little bit of her mask.
That's true. And the gold tones on it actually look like there's like some depth to them, like it's armor or it looks like the way Spider-Man's armor looked in the when Tony Stark in the movies armored it up. I don't know. Are we going to say who the other candidates are?
I think we can. I mean, I just like quickly know like connotations, but Luke Cage, Mayor of New York.
Yep,
that seems like if you're Luke Cage and you've got a kid and a wife and you're also Mayor of New York. I think being Venom is too much for him to take on.
I think it is, too.
I'm up for it. I don't think he should do it.
Unless the symbiote has, like, unhinged him in some way where he's...
Well, remember when Spidey originally had the symbiote, he would go to sleep and the symbiote went around swinging around with his body?
Right? Yeah.
So maybe, like, during the day he's the mayor and a dad, and at night he goes out and becomes Venom.
Sure.
I actually thought of the old Team America thing. Do you remember the Marauder from Team America?
No one else remembers that.
But do you remember
it? I do remember it.
The Marauder was a character who also he was created out of like the psychic energy from the team, but it could have been any one of them at any time. I feel like this is going to have some twist like that.
Let me ask you this. Have we ever seen Venom and the Masked Marauder and Team America in the same place?
Interesting.
I'm just saying, you went out of left field.
By the way, for those who don't know...
That's everyone.
Team America, somebody out there knows. Team America were stunt-riding Evel Knievel-style motorcyclists that Marvel banked on in the early 80s.
Yeah.
And they pushed them hard enough at the time for a solo series that only went 12 issues, or 11 issues, I think.
Mm-hmm. Crossover with quite a few
things. But they crossed over with quite a few things in that time, including the X-Men.
Yep.
And there you can find an issue of the New Mutants where, because of the uncovering of the Marauders' weird psychic link to them and how it worked, which was kind of like mutant-ish, they trained in the Danger Room at the X-Mansion. And at one point, you know, the New Mutants are like, we want to use the Danger Room, and Xavier's like, sorry, Team America is training. You just see these cyclists ramping, fighting giant mechanical tentacles and stuff.
They left skid marks all over the floor there.
So the other candidates are Rick Jones, the all-time ultimate sidekick, and he's teamed up with everybody. He's been a hero at times.
Bruce's best friend.
Yep, Bruce's best friend.
He's been Captain Marvel. He's been the Hulk. He's been A-Bomb.
Yep.
He's been...
He hung with Rom, I think.
He hung with Rom.
Yeah.
That's right.
And is there one more person?
Robbie Robertson.
Oh, Robbie Robertson, yeah.
That would be weird.
Not that weird.
Robbie Robertson is an old man running a newspaper.
But weird. So what? When you're in the symbiote, all is forgiven.
Wasn't he friends? Am I remembering this correctly? Friends with Tombstone growing up.
Yes, it was like a parasocial relationship. I think Tombstone. Tombstone thought he was best buddies.
But Tombstone's daughter is the Beetle who is marrying Robbie's son.
Correct.
Okay.
What just happened?
Yeah. None of them are Venom as far as we know.
No.
So here's my thought, though, is that I know Al Ewing. It's not going to just be some simple, like, oh, it turns out it was Rick Jones.
Yeah.
It's going to be, it's Rick Jones, but it's using the incarnation of him when he was Captain Marvel that made him susceptible to it. Or it's like, it's Robbie, but he blacks out during it. That was not a joke, a race joke. no, he blacks out, in the style of Spider-Man in the early symbiote costume.
And I know it sounds like we spoiled a lot of the issue, but we didn't. There's a lot here. There's a lot of really cool, well executed action.
Yep, and I liked the weird expert witness guy.
Yep.
Who kind of helps set the stage for thing.
And there's an ongoing thing. I thought it was just going to be a one-off, but it's like his ability kind of plays into it as it goes along.
Also, Venom does some unique things.
Yeah, it's true.
Its power in some unique ways. For a book that I didn't expect to have really any interest in, because I'm not a particular Venom fan, I like him all right.
I will say, I don't know this artist.
I was pretty happy with it.
This Carlos Gomez.
Yeah.
But really good job.
Yeah.
He's just got a really knack for good storytelling.
But also, I think, very detailed and cool designs, good character designs. So, all new Venom. Worth your time, I think.
I think so, too.
Give it a shot.
One of the big things this week is Absolute Superman number 2.
Yep.
We now have almost all the Absolute Superman in stock. We just don't have Absolute Superman number 1, but that should be next week, the week after, come back in. But I think with this issue, I think Absolute Superman is my favorite Absolute book.
Interesting.
Okay. I think I agree.
I mean, I really like what they're doing in Wonder Woman, but a lot of that is the art. Absolute Superman it's really interesting and kind of weird.
I also like its sort of perspective.
Yeah.
It's particular. It actually feels like, in a way, a callback to original 1930s Justice Warrior Superman. In a kind of a deeper way, you know, we always talked about Morrison flirted with this when he did Action Comics and the start of New 52 or whatever. And
basically the Bruce Springsteen version.
Yeah, the Super Bruce Springsteen. But he was a guy who was like, he had attitude toward cops. He was wanted by the law. He would bust, you know, like slumlords and people like that. And this is that guy. At the end of the last issue, we saw that, like, the Peacemaker forces were, like, led, at least a cadre of them, by Lois Lane.
Right.
She's working for the company, which, like, basically has almost, like, this indentured servitude of, like, miners in, where are they? Somewhere in South America? Brazil.
Yeah, Brazil.
They're in Brazil. And here, he has his first extended encounter with her, which is largely a kind of a chase sequence where they, the military division of this company is, like, trying to shoot him down, she is like handcuffed to him with his high-tech handcuff that he cannot get off.
Handcuffs,
yes, which he mistakenly calls him. And is trying to keep her alive, but also to get it off. And he's talking to like his own kind of symbiote suit thing, which has like it's the AI you talked about last time.
I really like the suit in this. It's a neat idea.
They do a number of things with the suit, which is quite cool. And the cape, which is not what I expected it to be. It's very cool how they visualize it. but you know, like they honestly had me hooked on the first page when they showed a young Cal on Krypton. They only say 6 years ago.
We have a very young Superman, which is actually really cool.
Is he maybe like 14 in this and like 22 or something like that? Or no, that put him at 20. Maybe that's how young he's supposed to
be. The two things I really liked about this. One is that people always complain about Superman. It's so powerful you can't. He seems to be in danger in this. Like he's not physically in danger so much, but he's like he's in danger of running out of power. In which case, then it's all over.
Yep.
And he has to run from these guys. He can't just stand. And I also like that Lois sort of notes, she's like, he has this sort of almost naive, like, he cannot lie. He seems like, she talks about him code switching from his, like, naive, quiet person to his, like,
kind
confident.
Of a leadership.
Yeah. And I like that.
But she says that, like,
of
both of them, like, ring as, like, completely real.
Yeah.
There's a lot of insight from her in it, and there's a, that has a thematic in the story, which I don't want to reveal, but. She is both kind of, in some ways, quite cold in this, and also has elements of the Lois we know in a really interesting way.
I thought the way they're going to use this to transition her from being like spec ops soldier to journalist, I think, is interesting.
It is. And also, I liked how that tied into that opening scene with Kal-El.
Also, the art is spectacular.
Oh, I have one word for you.
Yeah.
Tank copters.
Two words, Nix.
I hyphened.
Okay. Yeah, Randy.
There are tank helicopters. They are called hell tanks.
But yeah, I agree. This is a great issue. I like that it plays with kind of flashbacks going back to Krypton and present time. I like getting more with his parents. I think his parents are actually really interesting.
They finally actually did something with him that I like because it informs who he is, but it's not like it doesn't take away from who he is.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, Jason Aaron is killing this one. Yep. He really is.
Yeah.
There are four separate holiday specials this week.
Yep.
There's DC's Batman Smells Robin Laden Egg number one, which is one of their big prestige format. It's got John Stewart, Secret Six, John Constantine, Joker, Vixen, Dr. Midnight, Deadman, and Superman.
So the Dr. Midnight is drawn by Francesco Fregavia.
There's a Francesco Fregavia in here.
Yep.
I see that there's a Marv Wolfman story.
Mm-hmm.
By Paul Pelletier.
Is it bad that I thought that Marv Wolfman was deceased?
I also thought Marv Wolfman was deceased. Is he maybe? Is this like a final story?
I don't think he will.
I thought he died.
I guess we would hear more if we're probably thinking that sadly of George Perez. Yes. Who also worked on New Teen Titans with him, but
I thought there was a writer who died too.
And do you not think Marv Wolfman has died?
Marv Wolfman died.
Oh, did he?
No.
I was going to say, I don't think he did.
I was looking to see. I was like, I pulled up his like IMDb thing. No, he has not died. He is still alive.
All right. In fact,
has credits on My Adventures with Superman because of all the characters created.
Yes.
Yeah, Marv Wolfman is alive.
Yeah.
Yay!
And
writing for Batman Smells Robin Laden Egg.
Yes. There is also Marvel's holiday special, just called Holiday Tales to Astonish.
Yep.
Which has a Jerry Duggan, Phil Noto, Fantastic Four.
Yep.
A Daniel Kibblesmith and Pat Olef, Uncanny X-Men. And a Jingyan Wang, Dylan Burnett, Spectacular Spider-Man story. These are all fun characters and good creative teams. Then over the indie side of things, Image has a Dread the Halls, which is a four sort of holiday horror stories.
Yep.
All written by Jordan Hart and Chris Ryle with some different artists. And Dark Horse has Christmas 365, which is also a horror Christmas story.
I believe the notable thing on that is it's written by one of those My Chemical Romance guys.
It's Mikey Way.
I believe it's the bassist.
Oh, okay. It's not Gerard Way, but Mikey Way?
Yes.
Okay. I didn't know that was how that worked. I didn't know that there were brothers in the band.
I didn't know that either.
It's very Bee Gees.
Yep.
Also on the number one still, we have Deadpool Wolverine Weapon Extraction. This is where backup stories written by Ryan North have been collected into one big story. And that's all the number ones, but I did want to mention there's a lot of number twos this week besides Absolute Batman. We have the second issue of Batman, or Superman. We have the Batman Santa Claus Silent Night Returns second issue, which has a bunch of magic guest stars in it.
I need to read that. I liked the first issue of it last week.
It's fun. They're doing some interesting stuff with it, but they use everyone from Felix Faust to Gentleman Ghost to who's Constantine's Papa Midnight, maybe?
Okay, yeah.
A lot of those guys, they're tying it into Merlin and a villain from the Arthurian Age, that kind of thing. Batgirl number two, which is Takeshi Miyazawa art, and I thought they did. Did you read this, Nick?
This is the continuing Lady Shiva, a.k.a. her mom. And Cassandra Cain stuff.
Yeah, they're being hunted by undead ninjas.
Yep.
And they go to sort of a place that Cassandra's been like volunteering, and I thought the characters in there were really interesting.
I agree.
It's like a take your daughter to work day with Lady Shiva, so lots of fighting.
Sort of, except take your daughter to.
This is take your mother to.
Fugitives.
Take your mother to. Yeah.
I forget about Two Face number one, came out this week.
Oh, right. Yep.
That was kind of interesting. Two-Face, the sort of hook here, and there are some twists within the comic, is that Two-Face has somewhat wrangled his two sides and formed a sort of truce with the underworld of Gotham to act as like kind of a lawyer to adjudicate, what would you call it, problems between the mobs, I guess.
Okay, yeah.
It's a little like that Chip Zdarsky book that had the guy who was the detective working for the mobs. Newburn, where nobody would touch him by agreement of them. But in this one, yes, there is a judge who is the... Is it the Reaper from... I don't know if it's... what do you call it? Yeah, Judge Reaper... from Batman Year 2 and...
Oh, interesting.
What was the Batman animated movie that they did that
Mask
had...
Of the Phantasm?
Yeah, what was that? What did they call that villain?
Oh, Phantasm.
It was just Phantasm, yeah. Yep. Which I think was based on this. Anyway, so it is a courtroom drama with also lots of violence because Mr. Zazz is on trial here for... And there's some question of whether he did or didn't kill anybody and whether he's got a marking to prove it because he... compulsively does that, or not, and Harvey's got some twists and turns up his hand. There's some political machinations with the various mobsters that are represented there. Do they want the truth to come out? Do they not? Is Zazz telling the truth? Is he not? And there's a few reveals at the end. I thought it was an interesting idea, kind of a new take on Two-Face, and a new role for him to play. And I had pretty good art. Like, basically, if any of what I just said sounds a little interesting, I'd recommend trying it out.
Back to number twos, we got JSA number two. And then we got the rest of the week. And I think, Dave, you and I don't know where Nick landed on these, but Jed McKay has a double shot this week. He's got his Avengers number 21 and X-Men number 8. These are not tied together, but Avengers does have an Avengers and X-Men tie-in.
Yep. And I love this week's Avengers.
I thought this was maybe the best issue he's done.
Yes. You know, part of it, and I think we can spoil this part because it's the opening. The cover is like Avengers versus X-Men round two. But it's a sort of fake out. Carol shows up and talks some like trash to Cyclops.
Yep.
But it's basically the Han and Lando bit from Bespin. And then they're like, buddy, buddy.
Yep.
And you realize, oh, they're there for a baseball game.
Yeah.
And so you get in the classic X-Men baseball game style, you get a showdown between the Avengers and the X-Men. But also a lot of sort of real talk about recent events. Like, hey, can we count on you to back us up in this? Oh, hey, Beast, you haven't seen Tony Stark since... They kind of he had gone evil, and they, you know, this is now a revived Beast, and Beast asks the very reasonable question of, like, why didn't you stop me? You know, why did you let it go as far as it did? And I think Tony actually has a somewhat decent answer. Not a perfect answer, but the kind of answer that fits the continuity that they wrote there.
Yep.
I liked all the character interactions in this, and love where Cyclops and Carol end up with it.
Yep.
Yep.
Excuse me. I have a cold, y'all, so... yeah, it was just... I feel like McKay, even if I don't like every single story he does, he writes the kind of Marvel that I want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Also, like the Glob got a...
The what?
Glob gets a...
Glob got a great scene. Yes. And that's a character who, even though he's from the Morrison run, which I really liked, I would have been happy in some ways if he had never shown again. But if you're going to show him, this was interesting, because not everybody needs to be like some X-Men combat monster. And in particular, he is like the cook there. Yeah, he's like the chef.
Yep.
And they do actually a really good scene with him. Perfect example of, like... And actually, Jed McKay did something that that Morrison didn't even quite get around to, which is showing what the through line is on that. You know, Morrison is great with ideas, but then he moves on to the next thing.
Yep.
Everybody else has to kind of take these ideas and figure out how to move them forward. McKay was like, I'm going to use this character to remind people that not everybody has to go out and be a frontline combatant in X-Men, and that you can have successes elsewhere. So.
This is their Thanksgiving episode.
Yep.
Kind of come together for... food and friendship.
Yep.
And then X-Men is the start of the Reign on Grey Malkin four-part crossover between X-Men and Uncanny X-Men. Yep. In which
do we decide this is the worst title ever?
Yes, it's really bad.
people who don't read X-Men all the time may not recall that Grey Malkin is the lane that the X-Men mansion is located on. So it's an X-Men continuity. It kind of tends to come up.
But it is a prison. They've turned the X-Men's mansion into a prison for mutants.
Who's the they? Is it the government? Is it like...
I don't know.
I think it's like evil division of government.
But basically, they're this goes real into how evil they are, which I think they did pretty well. And then the X-Men just are fed up with it, and they go in because they've kidnapped the Beast.
Yeah, they're like, all right, let's bust this thing open.
And it's very satisfying.
Like, just super pissed.
Yeah, I by the way, Jed McKay is the guy, only person who should write Cyclops.
Yeah, he does a good job.
He definitely got it.
Makes him both a badass, but like the recent X-Men 97 cartoon, acknowledges the stick up the butt a little bit.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go a little bit differently. I think he's the only one who should write Juggernaut anymore.
His Juggernaut is great.
Really interesting.
When they show up, I love how badass the X-Men are when he's writing them, because they're being attacked. These government goons are like beating up on the Beast because he stood up for the other mutants.
Yep.
And the guards, like they're these big bullies. And there's a scene where like they're like, we're under attack. They teleport a warship in, and it's like they're terrified of the X-Men when they actually attack.
Yep. I'm also like starting to really like how they're using magic in this series, which I loved, you know, a few issues back how he wrote magic. It was like the best characterization I'd seen of her in years.
Dave, wait till you get to, if you actually do, in fact, get Midnight Suns. Their use of magic in that is similar to this.
Oh, badass.
And better, honestly. It's great.
Are you loving Quentin Quire?
You know what? They even did something decent with him in here.
Because who is it? No, that's in Avengers, isn't it? Carol says something to him about, like, why do you have this little dickhead with you?
Yeah, and Cyclops is like, he's a work in progress.
Yeah.
I guess, does he count it? Isn't he, like, one of those Omega-level telepath people? Yeah. So
he's super powerful.
You can see why they might handle him with a kid gloves, so to speak.
I like that they basically use him as a radio, though.
Yeah.
Keeping everybody psychically linked.
This was really good, and I'm curious to see what the rest of it looks like.
You know what I liked is... there are times that writers can keep their own... You know, like the first issue of The Question came out the other week. I liked that first issue. It was a good issue. But they kind of didn't do anything to give The Question any kind of decisive win or really cool moment.
Yep.
It was interesting. And then it just ends on like, oh, and there's a problem and it may be worse than we thought. And I was like, this is kind of a downer.
Yeah.
McKay is good at like letting these heroes have their moments.
Yep.
And so when the X-Men are like... hey, you know what? These guys have pushed us too far. We need to go kick some ass.
Yep.
I'm like, they are badass when they do it, and they're getting the wins. It's not like the threats are pushovers, but yes, the X-Men, you know, the heroes in these things need to have their moments. So, McKay, I feel like McKay and Ewing and one or two other guys, probably, I think it's safe to say Ryan North, are the best of the current face of Marvel for me.
Yeah, for sure. Avengers Assemble has its fourth issue this week. I don't love the writing on this as much as I love the writing on the regular Avengers, but I love the cast. And they use a character I sort of only vaguely know that is, like, apparently was Doom's bride.
What's her name?
I'm looking for it. Victorious.
Okay.
And she has this, like, massive level of, like, cosmic power. And she has been kicked out of Doom's Latveria. She's outside the force field. And she's trying to break in. And in so doing, she is, like, causing environmental damage to the country around her.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
And the Avengers are going to, like, basically try to talk her out, this spurned woman of, like, hey, maybe stop killing everyone around you trying to get into this thing that he doesn't want you in. It was interesting. Meanwhile,
this is like a metaphor for relationships gone bad.
The other half of the team is dealing with the new Serpent Society and their big mega weapon that they reveal. This is more what I am used to from the Avengers, a little more sort of superhero-y.
Yep.
Than what McKay has been doing is sort of a little larger than life.
Yep.
And I like it quite a bit. It's a good companion book.
I forgot to read that this week, but I had enjoyed some of what I'd read before on that. So
Amazing Wonder Man pretty well.
yep.
NYX number 6 has Mojo.
Oh.
And they do some cool stuff with him.
That's cool. I forgot.
I am liking this book. It's not 100% what I want it to be, but I like the ideas behind it. And the way they use Mojo is really interesting. And then Ultimates number 7, which this book is wild and weird.
Yeah. It's good, though.
And I like the world building and stuff that they're doing.
Who writes The Ultimates?
It is Denise Kemp.
Okay.
Anything else y'all have this week?
The second issue of The Exorcism at 1600 Pen, which is the What If the President's Daughter Was Possessed book.
Sure.
Yeah. It continues to get more and more interesting with, like, weird kind of creepiness factor. I love the art, and I just think it's a story that's done well. I mean, it's definitely kind of plays a little like The Exorcist, but
yep.
There's more to it. It's interesting.
Huh.
I'm sorry, I cannot meet with the head of state right now. My daughter is possessed.
I mean, there's a little bit of that, yes.
All right, let's take a break for a minute, and then we will come back and talk about some news and a trailer and various other things. All right, we've got just one little bit of news and one trailer we watched to talk about. Let's talk about the trailer. This is for the live-action How to Train Your Dragon. I believe I've talked about this in the past. I don't think you should be making live-action versions of animation. I think, in general, it's not worth doing.
But you have enjoyed some of them.
Yeah.
Aladdin?
Yeah.
What do you call it? Jungle Book?
Jungle Book. I like both of those.
All right, we may be at the end of it, but any others that are fairly universally agreed upon?
I think that's it.
I feel like I took
some enjoyment from some of the other ones.
I mean, I like the live-action version of Cowboy Bebop.
Yeah. No, I'm just... That's kind of different. I'm thinking these are Disney and Pixar-specific ones, or DreamWorks.
Here's the thing. How to Train Your Dragon is a pretty solid trilogy. Like, it's really well done. It's all well done. There's nothing that
beautiful
needs...
animation.
There's nothing that needs fixing about it. And so this idea of... The live-action version, which looks like a very straightforward live-action adaptation. Like, this is only for people who don't like cartoons. Those people don't deserve a new movie. Like cartoons, damn it.
It's true. Like animation.
This
is the same thing. It's the same thing.
Like, the dragon looks exactly the same.
It looks like Toothless.
No, he's got, like, slightly more detail, though.
Okay.
But not by much. It's like a different kind of, like, maybe, like...
This is kind of a teaser trailer.
Yeah.
It shows some, like, a little bit of dialogue, and it showed the scene where they meet.
Yeah.
But I guess the question is, will they be, you know, are they beefing up some elements of the story? Are they going to change some elements around?
But there's nothing I'd change. Like, this is a beloved trilogy.
So here's a question. If it's just a, instead of, I'm somewhat being devil's advocate here. It's not necessarily adding something, but it's just another way to enjoy a thing you already like. Is there anything innately wrong with that? I guess it's a waste of resources.
It's a waste of resources. This goes to the sort of, I don't know which critic it was who said, hey, maybe instead of making remakes of good movies, remake flawed but interesting movies.
That was Roger Ebert.
Was it Roger Ebert?
Yeah.
He's right. He's 100% right. Like, instead of How to Train Your Dragon live action, why not make a live action Atlantis? Why not make a live-action Treasure Planet? All these movies that are, like, never quite get the respect, but everybody who loves them. And maybe you could find a whole new audience for this movie that people would like.
Well, I mean, I think they want to make those, too.
But they're but not. They're not making those. They're just making...
I thought there was one of those that they were working on.
I don't know. Maybe not. They're making a live-action Moana, right? Aren't they?
Probably. Yeah, they are.
And they made, they're making a live-action, like, Lion King prequel, which seems like a, which seems like a weird idea. Like, I mean, at least that's a story we haven't seen before.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. There's no reason to tell that story. But that's... At least that's something new. Like... I don't understand the idea of This is like the Psycho shot-for-shot remake. Like, why do that? It's a waste of everybody's time and resources.
Well, see, Randy, if somebody watches classic Psycho,
yeah,
they'll be driving around in cars from 1960.
What?
And they'll be like, well, wait, shouldn't he just be in a self-driving car?
Right, I can't relate to him if he's not driving a Tesla. This is what it feels like to me. It's the dumbest thing in the world. I don't understand why they're throwing so much resources. Actually, I guess I do, because for some reason, some of these are successful.
So I'm a little puzzled by this.
Yeah.
Because the director of this one, or the writer of this, is Dean DeBlois, who is the guy who wrote and co-directed all the How to Train Your Dragon movies, and Lilo, he also co-directed Lilo and Stitch.
Oh, there's a live-action Lilo
and he's
Stitch.
Working on
you
the...
You say he's the director?
Yeah, and he's working on the new Lilo and Stitch. Is this a guy who just likes his... things and wants to just keep doing
them? Yeah, maybe. I mean, here's the thing.
I mean, if
you had done this and Disney comes to you and is like wants to give you a whole bunch of money to do the same thing again, of course you're going to take the money.
Yeah.
I have no problem with the people working on this movie.
No.
It's Disney. Like, what are you doing?
I am...
Although this isn't Disney. This is DreamWorks, this is DreamWorks, right?
Whatever. They're all the same.
I am amused that they Jared Butler is starting to play his dad. He voices his dad sure. And he's like, well, you know, Jared Butler's kind
of... When I see this kind of resource waste, all I look is all the things you guys didn't make. And didn't do. And then there's like, there's
Randy,
some
you gotta be careful. Otherwise, if you do that, you'll start falling into the same camp of the people who are like, they're making too many superhero movies when they could be making art house movies like I want.
Sure.
Are you that person too, Randy? Is that you now?
I will say, I think they could have made a lot of art house movies. There's probably at least one solid mid-range hit that could have been made with the money they're putting into How to Train Your Dragon live action. And I think those people may have a point on this one.
Yeah.
I think...
Certainly, this trailer isn't like it looked fine.
It looks fine. Scene, it's very scene, pretty.
The scene with the thing where he meets the dragon looks is well done. But it's basically the scene from the original.
I mean, costuming wise, scenery, like this is well dragon done. Wise. This is skilled people doing something impressive. But it feels so pointless to me. I don't understand. Yeah.
I guess we will return to it one more time when they do probably the more full trailer.
Yeah.
And we can see if are they even trying to stretch some muscles.
Right.
Or is this one of those shot-for-shot things that's really weird?
Yeah, I don't get it. I don't understand. On the other hand, there's a movie right now that's out called Queer, or is coming out.
Uh-huh.
That is
the Daniel Craig thing.
Oscar-nominated filmmaker Luca Guadagnino.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Daniel Craig. They are talking about their follow-up together being Sergeant Rock.
Oh, right.
That's crazy.
This is where Daniel Craig would be playing Sergeant Rock.
Yep.
Now, he might have aged out of even Sergeant Rock, who's a craggy guy.
Oh, I don't know. He kind of is...
Like, you could probably pull it off.
He feels a little old for Sergeant Rock to me, too. Yeah. But
it's starting to stretch it.
Daniel Craig is Sergeant Rock? Sure, I'll come
like, Sergeant
that.
Rock should probably be around 40 or something like that.
Weirds me out that Luca Guadagnino wants to do a Sergeant Rock.
It's very strange.
Guadagnino is known for very art house films like Call Me By Your Name and The Bones and All, the Timothée Chalamet
thing. Must have grown up
it's
with
weird.
It, right? He must have read the comics.
Like the remake of Suspiria and Challengers.
This is all sort of in rumor territory. We don't usually talk about these things, but it's so weird we talk
Yeah,
about
that, that one
because
was
it's like it seems like something they want to do.
Yeah,
that's the crazy thing.
So I do want to give you my favorite thing about this. This is a Deadline article. Is Deadline's version of Sergeant Rock as they're explaining Sergeant Rock to people?
Oh yeah.
The character of Sergeant Franklin John Rock was created by Robert Kaniger and Joe Kubert and first appeared in the 1959 DC issue Our Army at War as a World War II soldier who served in the infantry. The character gained steamed in 1977 when he received his own comic book series, which ran until July 1988. Rock's talent includes shooting down German planes with a single submachine gun and tossing grenades with great accuracy. When he's without a gun, he's a great street fighter and can survive gunshots.
What a weird way to put it.
He's a calm guy with heart, but also has a combat antenna able to detect an incoming enemy siege. I've read a lot of Sergeant Rock. All of that was new information to me.
Yeah, I feel like he may occasionally do the, hey, the old combat antenna's going off. I feel like there could be some...
Now, is that a literal... pops it out of his helmet, it's a combat antenna?
G.I. Robot has an actual combat antenna.
It was a steampunk series.
I'm sure we'll see that combat antenna on Friday when Creature Commandos premieres,
yes. But that whole... I was like, that had the air of either AI writing... Or a dude who was given a lesson. It's like, hey, talk about the Sergeant Rock movie. And he went to Wikipedia and is like, here's what I found.
Right.
Which I found was hilarious.
Yeah, if someone were to ask me to describe Sergeant Rock, I'd say he's like, in some ways, a consummate sergeant, a gruff but loyal member of his platoon, who always headlined a group of colorful misfits, a little bit like, you know, honestly, like, Fury Head.
I was going to say, I'd probably go into Nick Fury territory at one point.
I think both of those were invented not in the 40s. Or was there Sergeant Fury? Were there Sergeant Fury comics in the 40s? Or what, like Sergeant Rock, was it...
More of a 70s invention?
Or 60s.
Yeah.
60s, they were getting nostalgic for the war. Like, that was a good one.
Yeah, I think that's about right. So Sergeant Fury.
By the way, you know what's crazy back then? Back then it was agreed upon that Nazis were bad. And weirdly, not anymore.
Today we seem to have some issues with that.
Sergeant Rock first appeared in 1959.
Sergeant Fury appeared in 1963.
Okay.
Okay. Rock beats Fury.
Classic. Yes. Rock beats Fury, yes. All right. That's our
Sergeant Rock, paper, scissors.
We've got some other topics to talk about, and I mentioned a little bit last week, Wicked.
Yes.
Nick, you've not seen?
I have not seen.
And Nick was saying that he might not be in the biggest hurry to see it because he has never had any attachment to the Wizard of Oz.
It's true.
Dave, on the other hand, is a Wizard of Oz fanatic, a freak, an Aussie, as they call it, a Wizzy.
Are you done?
I don't know. You tell me. I don't know what Wizard of Oz fans are called.
I don't know. Ozheads. I think they're Ozzians or something like that.
Emerald Foresters.
Are you done?
Nope. No, I got a million of them.
No, I liked Wizard of Oz when I was growing up. Yeah. I read all the books.
Yep.
I actually saw Wicked on a touring Broadway thing maybe 10, 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. And liked it a lot, but found that it had slipped from my memory. So, you know, other than remembering that it presented a sympathetic portrayal of the Wicked Witch in her younger days and sort of showed about her falling out with her, college-age bestie, Glinda, who would become known as the Good Witch. I didn't remember any of the specifics.
Let me ask you, Dave, as a more of a long time, Elphaba, was that created in like the Wicked books, or is that somewhere prior to?
So I believe that and like the Shiz University, both from the Wicked book. I don't believe they have any basis in the Frank Baum books from the like early 1900s.
Elphaba is a weird name.
It's a weird name.
It's no weirder than Mombi.
It's funny, though, because, like, people have... It's been in the pop culture so long that people remember it. It's not like... it's kind of like people saying Dengar from Star Wars or Sebulba.
No, Dengar is a perfectly usable bounty hunter name. That's a good one.
Sebulba and Elphaba would get along.
I do think Sebulba... Because Sebulba is like Elphaba. I think he's been given a bad rap. He was just trying to win a pod race.
I'm defying gravity. Oh no.
This does point the idea toward a Star Wars musical, which we haven't had yet and probably should.
I believe at least a one-shot sort of special, like a movie or something like that.
It is Max Rebo's time.
Yes.
Although that singer that they CGI'd in can go to hell.
Oh yeah, that one sucked.
Yeah.
But Wicked. So we both saw this separately. I believe we both enjoyed this movie
quite a bit, actually. I'd know much about it. My knowledge of Oz is reading those Scotty Young and Eric Chenoweth Marvel adaptation they did of all the books.
Yep.
That were really good and gave them more of a depth of it. But I think one of the things we talked about the trailers we were sort of down on the trailers that they were sort of hiding it was a musical. It didn't seem like the best trailer.
Right.
The thing I'll say about the trailers, having seen the movie, they don't give away the story. And I do appreciate that. Like, they definitely portrayed it as, oh, the wizard is actually, like, in on it with Elphaba, and they're trying to, they're creating a villain for the good of Oz.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, no, that's not at all what's going on, but the trailer made it look that way so you wouldn't see the twists coming.
Right, right. Yeah, there are some interesting twists and turns here if you don't know it. But, like, the heart of the story, or the way it begins, I should say, actually, they begin with a pretty cool sequence that sort of would be the Ding Dong the Witch is Dead sort of moment. Yeah. Where Glinda comes to the Munchkins and is like confirms that she's dead and that they're released from her her tyranny.
Yeah.
And they're all really pretty excited about that in a sort of morbid way.
Yeah.
And she's like thrown out some little lines about how, well, it's also lonely to be wicked and stuff like that. And they start asking some questions of her, which leads to the first of several flashbacks.
It is a little messed up, by the way, that you get over and people are like singing about how your college bestie. They're so glad she's dead.
What I don't remember is, because this is by the way, Wicked Part One.
Yep.
The second half of the play will be released next year. They did film them close together, so it's basically just a year apart.
Yeah.
But I'm like, okay, the Wicked Witch was pretty doing objectively bad things and was super mean in the Wizard of Oz movie.
She did try to set the Scarecrow on fire.
Incredibly uncool.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, what could have pushed her to that? Well, they sort of reveal some of those things in here. But still setting the Scarecrow on fire is objectively jerky.
What if the Scarecrow's an anti-animal racist?
I mean, that could be.
Then you'd set him on fire.
We see that she was, in a kind of darkly funny scene, I guess, she was born when her mom had a fling with, like, a traveling kind of salesman person.
Yeah.
And also weirdly born green. I wonder why that could be.
Her dad's a jerky munchkin.
He's the mayor or governor of Munchkinland.
Yep.
But he's often away and doing business and stuff like that. And so... He's a little startled when his kid comes out green.
Yep.
That witch green color. And she is always kind of the green-headed stepchild of the family. Yeah. Whereas the dad dotes on her sister, though she's confined to a wheelchair. But she is like the bright prospect, and he really almost treats her like she's not even around. Uh-huh. He's extremely negligent. He's a piece of shit.
Yep.
But
I hope she sets him on fire.
Yeah, I hope she sets him on fire. does he know? Does he infer 100%? Do we know that she was born of infidelity?
They don't really talk about it, but it seems to me like he knows.
Yeah.
But so she goes off to school. With her sister.
Yep.
Fast forward. To school. And then
by the way, this was not the case in the original play.
Oh, really?
I was looking up differences. It's not a huge thing. But she actually was just attending the university when you first see her. I think they decided to suggest that basically her dad was not going to pay for her to go to the university or anything like that.
Yep.
So she's just there to kind of watch over her sister, the golden child.
Yep.
There. When she displays a talent for magic, it's kind of like raw magic. She can't really control it well, but it gets her on the sights of one of the professors, played by Michelle Yeoh.
Yep.
Who's like, oh, you seem really promising. I'm going to pull some strings and we're going to get you into the school.
Yep. And she buddies up with Glinda.
Yes, Glinda, who is played by Ariana Grande.
And she's great. She's fantastic in this.
What's the name of the other actress who plays...
Cynthia Erivo.
Elphaba. Say it again.
Cynthia Erivo,
yeah.
And I believe there's been a bunch of like, they're, like, best buds. There's a lot of interviews. And that they're, like, they're so in love with each other. And
I love it.
It's very cute.
That's great.
If you've seen... Go see some of those. And they clearly, like, bonded.
What's funny is, I think, one of my favorite... not iconic songs from it was the bit where so they end up rooming together.
Yes.
And they to don't get along, to say the least. In fact, the first song that they sing together is a duet about how they loathe each other.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Super funny and clever.
They're the prince guy or whoever shows up.
And we should quick say Glinda is a very vain, privileged girl. Excuse me.
Very popular. Everybody loves her.
And it's in this kind of exaggerated way of musicals. She's got sort of some campus groupies.
Yeah.
and considers herself like if she helps you out, she's like, I'm such a good person. Yeah. You know, yeah. That's she's a not a good person necessarily, but not a terrible person. No. She's just like, she's been shaped by this life of privilege and nobody ever checked it.
So I will say, one thing I really liked about this is I didn't know about the someone is sort of scapegoating the animals, actual scapegoat.
Yeah, so Oz, of course, has some talking animals, and you'll see them like some occasionally around.
One of them is voiced by Peter Dinklage.
Yep. In fact, the midwife at in the birthing scene, yep. That was apparently added as well to the movie, okay. I think, to emphasize the breadth of their animals' appearances, and also I think probably portray another benevolent one.
Yeah,
because there is animals. It does seem like in this world they have to be like maybe taught to speak, or they would just go on being sort of animals.
Yeah,
and indeed, someone seems to be trying to take away their voices.
Yeah.
You don't know exactly what's going on, but there is a concerted effort behind the scenes. Animals are going missing.
Yeah.
And so forth. And her professor, who's played by Peter Dinklage, yep. voiced by him, really, really, really good little small role.
Yeah.
Wow. Is
wow,
taken off, like hauled out of the classroom.
Yeah.
Very, like an enemy scene, of the state kind of thing. And if you feel, this is when I was like, oh, this movie actually has, and this is based on a 2005, I think, is when Wicked first debuted.
Yeah.
Based on a 1990s book, but has some extremely relevant themes to today.
Yeah.
especially about power mongers scapegoating, and the particular methodology of that of how that works. But yes, this event sort of galvanizes things, and we don't need to say I think too much more about the plot. But the few other, there is another player in there who is the romantic interest of Ariana Grande's Glinda.
Yeah, but also sort of a romantic interest of Elphaba.
He's a handsome student named Fiero.
Yeah,
who has been like apparently kicked out of a lot of schools because he's like a party boy.
Yeah,
he's a fuck boy.
But he's got more depth than you see.
He does, and that surprises him and surprises everybody, I suppose, because he does get one or two good songs about like. But that are celebrations of kind of burying your head in the sand and not getting caught up in the books and stuff like that, which is a terrible lesson.
Yeah.
It seems like he is that's the surface read on him.
Yeah. You know, one thing I would say, the look of all this thing is great. There's a library with like spinning bookshelves. It's a super cool production piece. They do, as you noted when you were talking about online, there's a lot of CGI, but it's actually well-done CGI. Like, this is a very beautiful-looking movie.
Oz is meant to be one of these places that has, like, a lot of visual splendor and a lot of very, big, bright colors. Even the original movie really, really pushed that. It was one of the
first big color movies.
Right. Yeah. And so CG seems like it's one of those things that's fairly appropriate for that.
The their green steam locomotive is such a cool design.
Super cool.
And the other thing, though, is I realized...
Also, the costuming is all great.
The costume's all great. I don't really know these songs except for Defying Gravity
and Popular.
And none of them stuck in my head. Like, I didn't think... I was not like, oh, I love all this music. It wasn't like when I've seen a bunch of music where, like that thing goes in rotation, like when I saw Hamilton, where I loved every song in it.
Right.
I actually didn't... The songs didn't stick. They're good.
Yeah.
But nothing stuck with me like Popular and Defying Gravity. And I'm curious if that will happen more as I watch more of it.
Yeah, and it may be one of those kind of things. You need to be like a musical high school student, the musical theater student, and listen to it 100 times.
Yes. Yeah.
Then they'll stick, Randy.
But I did think this was really good. I cannot wait for part two. I thought they did a great job with this.
Yeah, I was very happy with it as well. I don't think I had any major complaints other than maybe... a little showy with some of the CG stuff. And you know, these kind of movies always go a little bit in their big numbers. I know that they'll, you know, they want to have a little CG enhancement. And, you know, like instead of having a crowd of what had been like probably 20 people on the stage in the play, let's have 400 people, you know, because you can do that digitally.
Do you think the two-part movie is warranted for this?
Yes.
I think so.
I don't know what I would have cut out.
Everybody I know who's seen it or talked about it seriously thinks so too.
Yeah, okay. I don't know what I would have cut out. And I think it's a good end point when they get to it. I'm like, yeah, I want to see what happens next, but
it seems like those scenes needed to breathe for their emotional depth. Like they couldn't if you had hurried it along and cut some songs, I think it would have been a little unfortunate.
I agree. I do think I'm not thrilled with this trend of two-part movies. But I do think if you're going to do it, shooting them back-to-back so the next one comes out the next year is the way to go. I think we're all waiting for the next part of Spider-Verse and Fast Furious and Mission Impossible and something else. Dune did that. Like there were like eight of them in the last year or so that were like that.
You know, I got one or two of them, too.
The big, the ultimate deciding factor is if it's good enough.
Yeah.
If it hadn't been good, if it had been more like the way, you know, like, I'd say the first Hobbit movie was pretty good.
Yeah.
The second one was pretty not good.
Yeah.
And the third one was slightly ass. And they, and so that hurt. As long as they can, the second half is at least as good as this, I think they're fine.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they will be.
They've proven it with the quality. But if the second half is ass, then this will, by transitive property, become ass.
The director is quite good.
I was saying, John Chu now has done In the Heights, which is really good. People should watch that if they haven't seen it.
Yep.
And Crazy Rich Asians, which is super watchable.
Yep.
Really good. And now this. I'm like, this guy has had a pretty good track record with
me. You know what? Maybe he should do the Star Wars musical.
Yeah, let's do it. John M. Chu, Star Wars musical. Let's hit it.
He also did Step Up 2.
Okay.
I don't know what that is.
It's Step Up to the Streets, Dave.
Oh, okay.
It's a break dancing.
You got served.
Oh, okay. But I want to see Lando Calrissian sing.
Agreed. And dance.
Well, you can get Donald
Glover. Oh, you know what else? Do you know what else John Chu directed? G.I. Joe Retaliation.
Yeah, he did.
Wait, which the good one?
Yes, the good one.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
All right.
This dude has directed some good stuff.
Wicked and G.I. Joe Retaliation.
Did he also do Now You See Me?
What's that?
Now You See Me Too.
Well, he's directed 29 movies, apparently, so.
I feel like he did Now You See Me Too.
I guess he's been busy.
So he did. I'm looking to see what else he directed. Now You See Me Too. He did direct Now You See Me Too.
Yep.
Is that any good?
I liked it. I like the magic movies with
I thought I heard that the Mark second Ruffalo. One wasn't so great.
It was a little out there, but I like Daniel Radcliffe's inclusion.
And he's done some stuff. Oh, he directed Joan the Holograms.
Yeah.
Oh, wild.
Yep.
Yeah. And something called Good Trouble, which now I'm curious about because I liked everything else he's done.
Sounds like that's obviously a callback to I suddenly can't say that.
Yeah, no, but it's not John Lewis. It was a Freeform show or something. He must have directed an episode of it. Like, it wasn't clearly everything, but yeah. Interesting.
But yes, Wicked is worth your time.
Yep, go for sure. For sure. All right, Nick, you were going to talk about you had watched Day of the Jackal.
I haven't watched all of it. I've watched the first half, so I think the first five episodes.
Right, and this is not either of the two pre-existing,
It is not the
Day of the Jackal movies.
It's not the 1973 movie, and it's not the 1997 with Bruce Willis movie. Yep.
This is a TV show based on the concepts of the original movie.
Original, but definitely diverting a bit because it focuses on the Jackal himself as a character that has a backstory and a secondary life and.
Uh-huh.
It's kind of delves deep into that, and I think it's a really interesting portrayal of this, and then of Lashana Lynch plays a British MI5, I believe she is.
Okay. Huh.
She's a weapons specialist and kind of gets on his trail because of the certain weapon that he uses, sniper rifle that he uses.
And it does fit the original movie in the sense that that was like a movie told equal parts from the police and from the Interpol type people and the Jackal.
But it's weird that I'm kind of rooting for the Jackal. Who's supposed to be like a ruthless hitman who is.
Well, you're seeing somebody going through this dangerous process, like it's easy to kind of fall into that.
But it's also like kind of this weird mirror image between the two that they're not too dissimilar because this person is killing people for money, but the woman who is part of the British police is doing equally atrocious things in order to catch him. Of like some end up killing people inadvertently, and I'm just like, it's this weird cat and mouse game that is kind of coming to ultimate collision between the two of them, but there is a lot of fodder in between. But the action sequences are really well done. The Jackal is played by Eddie Redmayne.
What's the level of realism?
I think it's pretty realistic, honestly. Okay. It is not Bond. It's definitely more kind of... there are some interesting, like, kind of weapons. Like, the sniper rifle he has is, like, specifically masked as, like, a carry-on bag. Basically, the entire bag, like, breaks down into, like, a composite sniper rifle.
Yeah.
Which I thought was an interesting idea. Eddie Redmayne as... an assassin I wasn't 100% sure I would take seriously because he's kind of a waif of a man.
Yeah.
But he portrays it really, really well.
He's also a good actor.
He's a great actor. And he's able to sort of... The Jackal was always supposed to be kind of like a mimic in some ways. Like, he can become, like, with prosthetics and stuff. And they do a really good job of portraying that. I just thought the feel of this show is really, like, high-end. Hmm. I mean, it's British, but... It's British made, but I was glad to see Peacock pick it up, and I hope it's done well because I want them to do more kinds of things like this. And like everyone involved in this, a lot of character actors. The guy who was Peacemaker, who was the butterfly, but posing as like part of the good group. Is it Chibuti Uji? He's a very, very good actor. And Charles Dance is in this. But it's all about basically killing a Elon Musk type person. And I'm kind of like, oh, I'm really rooting for the Jackal. But if any of what I'm saying is interesting, or if you kind of just like spy cat and mouse games, this is really, really good. If you like any Greg Rucka whatsoever, this feels like something
If somebody just likes Heat?
Sure.
Heat seems like another prototype of this.
Yeah, it very much so. Maybe we'll see a Heat 2. I don't know. I don't know if I want to see Heat 2.
I don't want to see Heat 2. I read that book. I don't want it.
The script might end up being something a little bit different, though.
Yeah, true.
So we'll see.
Possible. But yes, watch this. I think it's all out. I need to finish watching it, but it's really good.
Dave, you and I got a chance to play Thunder Road Vendetta on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, it's a board game.
I've talked about this before.
Yeah, that was a very fun game that was, I want to say, like, slightly, in some ways, goofier than I expected it to be, but a very fun game. Thunder Road Vendetta is a Mad Max-type game where you're racing along these jagged and... damaged, burning, trapped roads, and all sorts of mayhem around it. And the interesting things about me that maybe I didn't quite fully pull in from your description in the past is, one, everybody has three vehicles in this, with some possible exceptions with some of the expansions, but in general you get three vehicles, a small, medium, and large car, armored vehicles. The larger ones are easier to hit, and they each have kind of their own advantages. But I didn't realize how messed up the map was.
Yeah.
That it is just like it makes when you do your move, the strategy of trying to figure out where you end up is a big thing.
You're like, well, I could end up in the mud, which is dangerous. I could be in the edge where I might get knocked off, or I can kick the straight path, but I got to go through two mystery obstacles that could be really bad.
Yep. Although it's funny because the mystery obstacles can every once in a while actually help you if it turns out to be like a patch of ice or whatever.
Or a ramp. At some point somebody discovered a ramp, right?
I think so, yeah. And let's see. So the most interesting thing is that there's a lot of collisions in the game.
Yes.
And when you collide, you roll these collision dice that can kind of bounce you around. And there's also... is it size or positioning of the vehicles?
Size. The larger vehicle gets a reroll.
Right. So if a little small vehicle hits a large vehicle and that owner of the larger vehicle wants them to re-roll, they have to.
Yep.
And you could get bumped either in almost any direction, and including backwards, essentially.
Right.
And that could like put you like on a mine on another car. Yep. You could essentially get pinballed around a little bit.
Yeah, if you get knocked into another car, that's just another collision. Like it can be like pinball.
Yep. Yep. And that turned out to be a lot of fun. Randy, you were playing with the big rig.
The big rig.
And
I was going to win that race, by the way, until you all sent your helicopters after me.
Yes. Oh, that's something else I didn't realize is everybody kind of has like an attack helicopter that's associated with their race team, essentially. And you can kind of call it in for strikes where it'll come in and do like little quick surgical attacks. But it also sort of remains on the map as yet one more obstacle for people until you move it again. And what I found is there's a lot of fun turnarounds in this game.
Yeah.
There was one person who, her cars got shot up very quickly early on.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, she's just going to be out of the game. But then, as time went on, no, she got very close to it. Okay. She was going to be the likely winner.
Yeah.
But you were sort of pulling ahead early on until we all started attacking you and eventually blew the big rig to pieces.
Uh-huh.
My cars, in a very rapid succession of turns were doing all right, but got blown up as well. Or in fact, I guess two of them were a little bit behind when somebody raced to the edge of a map and the final piece, the back piece of the map, essentially, if you're not past it, your cars detonate.
Yeah, if you're too far behind when they change maps, yeah.
And my cars got flipped. One of my other car got flipped or damaged. And while I was trying to get that lucky six to repair it, all the action was happening. But I think I got blown up too before then.
Yeah.
And then somebody who had been, I don't know, kind of in the middle most of the game, Sweet's character.
Yeah.
She was able to pour it on right at the end, and even though two of her three cars had been destroyed, that one car was
she did. Yeah.
She, in a surprise turn.
Yeah.
But yeah, it made for a good nail-biting game, I can see how like the other arenas that you can add, and the other vehicles, and even drivers that you can add, I see, can all add to the to make it feel even more unique each time. But it is a good fun game.
Yeah, it is
like
really
kind of high on the fun factor. Not a deep strategy game, but you probably will need at least one playthrough to sort of see how it works, you know, just to get the vibe.
Yeah, the only downside I'll say to it right now is it is the company that does it, they don't keep their stuff in print long enough. We've got all the expansions right now.
Yeah.
But we're out of the main game. And we kickstarted it. That's how we got it.
Right.
And it has not come back in.
Yeah, that's a little frustrating, but I guess that means that when it does come in, you should pounce.
Pick it up. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, as it's one of my favorite games. I was glad we got a chance to play it.
And also, as a quick aside, we played Creature Caravan, which we talked about last week. Yeah, we talked about last week, but it was that was a fun revisit.
Yeah. All right. I am doing a theoretically a holiday movie a day. We'll see how my list that I made is 21 movies. There are 25 days, so I'm already not planning to make every day. I will add more if I get to it. But it's mostly stuff I've already seen. There's a handful of things on there I haven't. But I started off with two that I have watched.
When you get to the end of this, I'm going to throw one out at you, and you tell me if you've seen it or not.
Okay.
It's my recommendation.
I want
to
hear it.
All right. White Christmas. Have you ever seen White Christmas?
I have. I didn't feel like it was much of a Christmas movie, actually.
It's not as much.
Yeah, I did. I watched it a few years ago, and it's solid.
It's sort of bookended by...
It's the one about them, like... It's the
general
holiday,
or whatever.
The Holiday Inn, right? Is that not...
Something like that.
Oh, no, no, no. I'm thinking of another... There's another one like that.
There's a guy who's like a retired...
It's Danny Kaye and Bing Crosby.
They're sergeant, yeah.
The Sister Act. Oh, that's right, yeah. Yeah, no, this is the one. They're trying to save an inn. They are military guys.
Yes.
But they're trying to save an inn. It's a weird movie. It is a weird movie.
I mean, it's not that weird.
It's kind of a weird premise.
It has a weird premise, yeah. but overall it's sort of about the sort of wholesome hijinks of a couple of soldiers who are I don't know, trying to get the girls and do something solid for their sergeant, who I think they don't really say it, but I feel like this guy has like PTSD.
Yeah,
like it feels like he's kind of had a rough go of
it. It's weird because he's a Broadway star, and a soldier, and it feels a lot like they would do this. Like, you know, like they would bring these guys.
Elvis did go into the army.
Yeah, it was like the Elvis movies where he's like, yes, he's a rock and roller, and also he's an army hero.
But you know what I loved in White Christmas is early on. There's basically they're in Europe in World War II.
Yeah,
and there's like a bombing run or something like that. And I guess Danny Kaye, who's just supposed to be a, you know, wannabe kind of singer-dancer.
Yeah.
He saves the... Who played the other guy?
Bing Crosby.
Bing Crosby. He saves him from something collapsing on him.
Yep.
And kind of uses that as leverage to, like, after when they go back to the States, he's like, yeah. Hey, maybe you could get me in your show. You know, I did save your life.
Yeah.
And but he, like, keeps on using it over time, and he's yeah. like, he's, yeah. It's a funny running gag. But it also has some good musical numbers. Yeah. Anyway.
It was fun. Anyway, you've seen it. It doesn't count as a Christmas movie to me, even though it's called White Christmas.
All right. No, it's a Christmas movie. anyway, so, but let's go on to what you did pick.
So, I watched Spirited. This is a...
I don't know what this is.
It's a musical on Apple Plus from, I think last year, was new last year? Or was it 2 years ago?
I think it might have been 2 years ago.
Anyway, it's Will Ferrell and Ryan Reynolds.
Huh?
And it is a riff on the Scrooge narrative, basically. Yep. But it's from the point of view of the ghosts. And this idea is that basically the three ghosts is actually a big operation.
Yeah.
And that they do every year they pick a Scrooge-type guy to, like, redeem. And that rolls on down and, like, creates more good in the world and that kind of thing.
That's funny.
So they're Jacob
Trickle
Marley.
Down.
Their Jacob Marley guy is, like, their CEO, basically.
Uh-huh.
And Will Ferrell is the Ghost of Christmas Present, who is, like, kind of their rock star. He's the guy who's the lead of the whole thing.
Uh-huh.
He's very enthusiastic about it. And they're trying to pick their... It starts off with them having rescued a Karen from being the Karen of the neighborhood. Her name's actually
uh-huh.
Karen. Played by Rose Byrne.
Uh-huh.
And she has been yelling at all the kids and calling the HOA on them, and it has her playing like hockey in the street with them, and then everything freezes, and all the ghosts show up, and they're like, you know, they celebrate with her about, you know, you've learned, you've changed, you're a better person, and then they immediately go into like, who are we going to pick for next year? And it's kind of right. So it's like almost behind the scenes thing.
Yep.
And they're talking to some guy that's like a hotel owner in Vancouver who's a big jerk, and Will Ferrell. Is kind of bored with all this. He's like, I'm not getting it. He's 400 years. He's not retired, even though he should have retired by now. And he starts advocating
for...
What
did you say, 400 years?
He's been doing this for like 400 years.
Oh,
he's a ghost.
He himself, not the guy who he's looking at. Yeah, yeah.
So they run across Ryan Reynolds, who is giving a speech to a Christmas tree trade organization.
Okay.
And he's like a consultant, and he's this very scummy, charming guy who's basically like... Yeah, we're going to start in a song, he's like, we're going to start a whole culture war about how plastic trees are bullshit, and you want a natural tree, or else you're... He's trying to get the boomers on board the whole, like, anti-plastic tree,
yeah.
So you can sell more real trees.
Right.
And he's, like, this scummy consultant guy.
Yep.
And Will Ferrell's like, oh, we got to redeem this guy. And Marley gives him a folder. He's like, this guy's unredeemable. You can't redeem him. And he's like, we've redeemed one before. And he's like, that was different.
Uh-huh.
And so it is about Will Ferrell trying to get this like team,
yep.
Which includes a very horny Ghost of Christmas Past, played uh-huh. by, I forget the, it's an Indian comedian.
Okay.
I forget her name.
Okay.
But she is, she immediately goes to like this guy, she goes to Ryan Reynolds, and she hooks up with him on the night while she's supposed to be teaching him. So Will Ferrell takes over as the ghost running all this thing.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of buddy up because Ryan Reynolds is a very charming, charismatic guy. And he's not having any of the Scrooge thing. He's basically like, he's like, no, this is ridiculous. He's like, I'm just doing what I do. People don't change. And that's sort of the narrative thing. It is a Scrooge riff.
That sounds interesting. Did we ever talk about this before?
No, we might have.
Because I don't remember hearing this particular spin.
I don't think we have, actually.
So the thing about this is...
It sounds like a kind of fun idea to take... Basically, am I correct that essentially you've got a jaded ghost?
You've got a jaded ghost. And well, no, he's not jaded. He is a very elfy-type version
of himself. Okay, very sincere.
Yeah. But he is also, like... He's been doing this for a long time, and he really is a true believer. He wants to redeem Ryan Reynolds, and okay. Ryan Reynolds is very cynical and jaded about the whole thing.
Okay.
So, it's likable. There's some fun stuff. There's a big reveal about who Will Ferrell is that makes a lot of sense, that sort of takes them back to some other, like, his past and that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And there's a really good musical number called Good Afternoon, where Good Afternoon is the equivalent of saying fuck you in, like, in Victorian England. And there's a big song and dance about that, which is very funny and weird.
So, yeah, my mind hadn't quite processed. Is this a musical?
It is a musical, okay. Yes. None of the music is super memorable.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any songs near
it. Just like Wicked? Those.
Yes, but not like Wicked. but it's solid. And when I watched it the first time, I was... And it's also like 2.5 hours long. It's probably at least a half hour too long.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is cute, Will Ferrell and Ryan Reynolds clearly both having a great idea, great time. Octavia Spencer plays Ryan Reynolds' assistant, and also like a love interest for Will Ferrell. She doesn't get a lot to do, but she's always great. Ryan Reynolds has a niece who his sister died, and he was supposed to be the guardian, and he's really not very good at it. And there's a little bit of like him helping her get elected student president by doing some nefarious things, and whether or not he's going to corrupt her.
Yeah.
It's okay. Yeah. When I watched it the second time, I liked it a lot better. Okay. But I think the thing is, I compared it to, say, Scrooged, which is my sort of bellwether for Christmas, for modernized Christmas story. And this is not on that level. In fact, it even references Scrooged.
Yeah, yeah.
But as I watched it again, I'm like, you know what? This is kind of sweet. It's got a good through line. It's got a good payoff. Good cast. I would recommend it if you like musicals and you like sort of Scrooged, modern-day Scrooge story. It's worth a watch.
Give it a shot.
Yeah. And then I watched the Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special, which is on my regular rotation every year.
Yep.
And is always great and holds up beautifully.
It's the specials, they only did this and Werewolf by Night so far, right? Yes. And I love both of those ones. Both just really good at what they do, and they both get in and get out in like, what, 45, 50 minutes, something like that?
Yep.
This, for those who don't remember, is the one where Kevin Bacon is in it.
Yes, as himself.
Basically, Peter Quill is kind of really down in the dumps and kind of depressed, and so Mantis and Drax decide they want to kind of give him a Christmas that calls back to his childhood or does something really special for him. And
so they go to Earth and kidnap Kevin Bacon.
Right, who, based on the stories that he's told, they've built up this myth where this guy who was just in a bunch of movies he liked is actually that guy from the movies, they think. I think, as you pointed out, Randy, when you posted about this, like, no one has ever been more game to kind of be spoof themselves and stuff than Kevin Bacon is in this movie.
He goes all in. Also, this is a great... If you ever play D&D or RPG and you're having trouble figuring out how to play your low-intelligence characters, Drax and Mantis are perfect. They're both very sincere.
Yep.
They've both got their powers, but they're so naive and dumb.
Yeah.
And it is delightful to watch them. When they go to Earth and they figure out that people will take pictures with them on Hollywood Boulevard for money... They get all this money and they go to a gay bar looking for Kevin Bacon.
Yep.
And they just get drunk.
Yeah.
It is hilarious. We're reminded on their behavior on Earth that these aren't superheroes. They are outlaws.
Right. Right.
And they crash.
Yeah. Actually, like Quill and some other people as their moral guidance.
Yes.
They will just do outlaw type things like kidnap
people.
They
break into Kevin Bacon's house and kidnap him and take him to space.
And smash cop cars.
Yep. but like the sort of best of these kind of things, it has a heartwarming ending that's actually really very sweet.
Yep. Also with James Gunn, dead perfect soundtrack.
Yeah.
There's some great, there's a new song by Old 97s, which is great.
Yep.
There's a new song that Kevin Bacon sings.
Yeah.
He does have his Kevin Bacon.
And then they use like Christmas Wrapping by the Waitresses. Yeah. I Want an Alien for Christmas, which is, I think, Blink 182. I'm not sure
Somebody
who that
like
is.
That.
But there's great use of Christmas music. And
it
also
is.
The Pogues, Fairy Tale of New York.
That's right.
There's a lot of great Christmas music used in this. It's really fun. It's a 45-minute watch. I definitely recommend everybody watch it.
Yeah, if you haven't already seen it.
Yeah.
And if you have seen it, go back.
Go watch it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I think that's it for us.
Randy, I got a few more questions for you.
Real quick.
You gonna watch Noelle, maybe?
Yeah, Noelle for sure is on there.
That's a good one. That was. I was surprised at how good that one was.
Disney Plus, Anna Kendrick and Bill Hader. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
How about anything darker like Krampus?
No, but I actually do have one. I've never seen.
Have you? You should watch Krampus.
I have seen Krampus.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
It might go on. I wasn't wild about Krampus.
Oh, I love Krampus.
I like that director. I liked Trick or Treat, but I didn't love Krampus. I have Rare Exports, which
I saw that, and I don't know why I couldn't quite get into it. It was pretty well done.
Yeah.
This is, for people who don't know, kind of a Christmas horror story.
Yeah,
but I do think it's worth watching.
So this may be the year I finally watch It's a Wonderful Life. May or may not. Every year that's on my list.
I will tell you in advance, Randy, that it's as much a Christmas movie as White Christmas is.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I will say, though, I kind of avoided it growing up.
Yep.
Because I think I watched it and I was bored by it because I was a dumb kid.
Yeah.
And I recently rewatched
it. It's so much more resonant as an adult.
Is.
And I'm not even like the biggest Jimmy Stewart fan, but I do like him, and it's a really good
darkness
movie.
And there's like heart to this movie, like in ways that you wouldn't expect.
Yep.
And you know, all I really knew about it was they showed the ending of it in the movie Gremlins as a kid.
Yeah. Sure.
And it, if you just take that out of it, it feels like so trite.
Mm-hmm.
That I just never wanted to see it. But yes, it's a completely different from what that would lead you to believe.
Also on my list, newer stuff, Claws on Netflix. Great anime movie.
Right.
Elf, of course. Elf, Scrooge, and Christmas Vacation. Those are my whole holy trinity of here. And then I've got a bunch of sort of action or horror adjacent movies like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Die Hard, Violent Night. Are all on there.
Oh, I think, Nick, did you ever see Christmas Horror Story? The three-story Christmas Horror
I did not. You mentioned that I needed to watch it.
You might want
to
watch that. Randy, I don't know if you're going to watch it or want to watch horror stuff, but that one, which has a fun side role for William Shatner in it, kind of is, he sort of forms the sort of narrative connection of the stories.
I have to watch The Muppet Christmas Carol at some
point. I don't love The Muppet Christmas Carol like everybody else loves it. Yeah, it's fine.
It's great.
I've also got the disappointing, and this may not make the watch, but the Christmas Chronicles that Kurt Russell did.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't wind up loving that, but I may watch it again.
I like fun both enough. Of them. They're
there's
fun.
Stuff. There's fun enough.
Yeah.
And on the Apocalypse.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
Nightmare Before Christmas. On the outside, I've got Violent Night. That one with David Harbour as Santa is definitely going to go. Die Hard, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Yep.
And Randy, I believe you and I are both independently found out we're going to go see the Die Hard play.
Yeah, the radio play.
It's being done in the style of like an old
theater,
radio show.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, local Round Rock Theater group that I've seen a number of productions of them and they're really good. A
couple of the Doctor Who Christmas specials maybe. The Doctor, the Widow, and the Wardrobe, which was the Matt Smith one that I really liked. And The Husbands of River Song, which was from the Peter Capaldi era, which I'm kind of curious to watch. I've never actually seen it. Happiest Season, the sort of lesbian Christmas Carol thing that
it's a good movie.
I haven't rewatched since I first watched it. And then, weirdly, Go. I forgot. I found a list of Christmas movies that are Christmas adjacent. I'm like, oh, that's right. That movie, Go, takes place on Christmas Eve.
That's wild. I remember that.
And it has some Christmas theme. And I'm like, you know, I might watch that. And then... The Outside, Harold and Kumar Christmas, and Phineas and Ferb Christmas are both on my list. So we'll see. That makes me a 21. Like I say, I'll add more if I wind up watching all of that. There's also probably some TV shows, like some Simpsons episodes and that kind of stuff that'll fit in there as well. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see if I keep up with it. It's day three, and I have watched two. So I technically am still on track.
Right.
All right. That, I believe, will take care of us for the week. We'll be back next week in the morning. Until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening!